Hello, everybody. My name is Tanya. I think I know most of you guys here, but if you don't know me, I am the resident here at ACCC as of August, but I've been sitting here for a while. Yeah, not a Zen teacher. This is my book report, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just going to read some things at you, and I'm interested in everyone's thoughts more than anything else. So today I'm giving a talk on spiritual bypass. It's something that I've heard spoken about in other sitting groups that I've been a part of before. And I feel like it's an important thing to discuss and bring to light. And I thought, why not now? So if you haven't heard of the term, it was coined by a Buddhist and psychotherapist named John Wellwood. The official definition is the tendency to use spiritual ideas and practices to sidestep or avoid facing unresolved emotional issues, psychological wounds, and unfinished developmental tasks. So we all know it's not uncommon in spiritual communities for things to go sideways. We've all heard the stories of Zen masters and leaders of institutions doing things that seem very un-Buddhist or un-Zen. And a lot of times people think, how could that possibly happen? And this is perhaps one of the reasons, but it's also something that can happen in communities, in your own personal practice, et cetera, et cetera. So I actually found an interview on Tricycle where John Wellwood sort of talks about it specifically. And he offers a few examples of ways this may show up in a sangha, in a personal practice, in your meditation. So I'll just read that right now. So he says, in my psychotherapy practice, I often work with Dharma students who have engaged in spiritual practice for decades. I respect how their practice has been beneficial for them. Yet despite the sincerity as practitioners, their practice is not fully penetrating their life. They seek out psychological work because they remain wounded and not fully developed on the emotional, relational, personal level, and they may be acting out their wounding in harmful ways. It's not uncommon to speak beautifully about the basic goodness or innate perfection of our true nature, but then have difficulty trusting it when our one's psychological wounds are triggered. Often Dharma students who have developed some kindness and compassion for others are hard on themselves for falling short of their spiritual ideals, and as a result, their spiritual practice becomes dry and solemn. Or being of benefit to others turns into a duty, or a way of trying to feel good about themselves. Others may unconsciously use their spiritual brilliance to feed their narcissistic inflation and devalue others or treat them in manipulative ways. People with depressive tendencies who may have grown up with a lack of loving attunement in childhood and therefore have a hard time valuing themselves may use teachings on non-self to reinforce their sense of deflation. Not only do they feel bad about themselves, but they regard their insecurity about this as a further fault, a form of me fixation, the very antithesis of the Dharma, which further fuels their shame or guilt. Thus, they become caught in a painful struggle with the very self they are trying to deconstruct. The Sangha often becomes an arena where people play out their unresolved family issues. It's easy to project onto teachers or gurus, seeing them as parental figures, and then trying to win their love or else rebelling against them. Sibling rivalry and competition with other Sangha members over who is the teacher's favorite is also common. Meditation is also frequently used to avoid uncomfortable feelings and unresolved life situations. For those in denial about their personal feelings or wounds, meditation practice can reinforce a tendency towards coldness, disengagement, or interpersonal distance. They are at a loss when it comes to relating directly to their feelings or to expressing themselves personally in a transparent way. It can be quite threatening when those of us on a spiritual path have to face our woundedness, our emotional dependency, or primal need for love. I've often seen how attempts to be non-attached are used in the service of sealing people off from their human and emotional vulnerabilities. In effect, identifying oneself as a spiritual practitioner becomes used as a way of avoiding a depth of personal engagement with others that might stir up old wounds and longings for love. It's painful to see someone maintaining a stance of detachment when underneath they are starving for positive experiences of bonding and connection. So yeah, that's a lot of different ways that this can show up, and obviously it's different for everyone. I know personally, I've talked about this in my What Am I Doing Here talk. I think when I first came to Buddhism and mindfulness, I sort of used meditation as like a silver bullet for my anxiety. And it was something that I could use to just calm my nervous system down, empty my brain, and feel much better. And that worked for quite a long time until it didn't, of course. And, you know, you're left really two choices, which is to continue to lean in to your denial of your present experience, which may be influenced by your past or your woundedness or whatever it may be, or to face it. And for me, I think it was sort of two-pronged. I think my practice certainly had to adapt and deepen in a way to include a variety of experiences, like even those that are negative, and maybe not see them as objectively bad or making me worse as a practitioner or something of that sort. And like many other people, I also went to therapy. And I found therapy to be very helpful. And I think it's important to note that meditation practice can give you a lot, but I do believe that, you know, anything for the wrong circumstances or the wrong person can be used as a tool or as a weapon. And if your practice is harming you, you know, I think that's something to address. And there's other tools to help you work through that practice. I think through the practice, you can work through a lot. And sometimes you need a little help, and it's totally okay to seek that help outside of mindfulness, Buddhism, and et cetera. But I wanted to read a little something that I found on, let's see, the Great Mountain Zen Center's website, which is a Zen center in Colorado. And they sort of talk about the sort of stages of spiritual bypass and sort of how that plays out over time. So they write, in initial stages of spiritual development, a practitioner is often developing the foundation for their spiritual growth by finding ground in mindfulness and concentration meditations. This trains the mind to concentrate, to be still, and to find a new level of internal peace. As a container for sitting still with discomfort enlarges, the emotional unfinished business of one's past begins to percolate up from the subconscious. In spiritual bypassing, when emotions are present, concentration practices are often used to redirect the mind to breath or to the sensory perceptions, such as sound. In emotionally inclusive spiritual practice, rather than diverting one's attention away from the emotions, the intermediate to advanced practitioner engages the emotions with attention and feels them directly. This can be a challenging time for a practitioner. As their practice matures, they may lose that initial peace and serenity that was found early on. In the beginning, sitting still with emotional energy is like riding a bull. Many practitioners may leave their practice at this point or go shopping for another practice and spiritual center that they imagine will offer a higher level of transcendence. Mature practitioners will stick it out with the understanding that the emotional discomfort is a necessary and essential part of the path toward freedom. Eventually, equanimity develops and the emotional life is no longer as scary nor rocky. Not only has the container of awareness grown large enough that it can hold the emotions, like the sky encompassing a cloud, the underlying emotional baggage, trauma, and unhealthy belief systems from one's youth and beyond have been deflated of their pressure, making them less equally triggered and even non-existent. I really like this summation of the journey, and I've found it to be true for myself. I still think I'm working through plenty of things, but some things I feel like I've seen through the end, some things I feel like I'm in the middle, and some things I feel I'm still in the initial stages. But I really liked the metaphor they used about the cloud, like the sky encompassing a cloud. And I sort of think of it in a way sort of like the eye of a storm. People think of enlightenment or, you know, spiritual prowess as this feeling of, you know, freedom and transcendence and all these wonderful things. And if they're having negative experiences, it's perhaps an indication that they're on the wrong path. But I think the winning ticket is, well, I think not the winning ticket, but rather the unfortunate truth is that you have to take a good look at your bullshit before you can get to the good stuff. And it's sort of like walking through the storm to get to the eye. And it's not that the stuff is gone, but you have a much better perspective on it and a better understanding. And I think that within itself can be a very healing experience. And I guess the final question is sort of, you've gone to therapy, you don't want to go to therapy, therapy doesn't work for you. You're relating to feelings of spiritual bypass. What can you do? How can you incorporate things into your practice to face hard things, face your own woundedness, your own trauma? And I found that Thich Nhat Hanh has some really great material on self-compassion and healing the inner child. And I found a little excerpt from his book, literally named Reconciliation, Healing the Inner Child, which is available on Plum Village website. And I thought it was really beautiful the way that he put it. So he says, "In each of us, there's a young, suffering child. We have all had times of difficulty as children to protect and defend ourselves against future suffering, which we often try to forget those painful times. The wounded child asks for care and love, but we do the opposite. We run away because we're afraid of suffering. The block of pain and sorrow in us feels overwhelming. Even if we have time, we don't come home to ourselves. We try to keep ourselves constantly entertained, watching television or movies, socializing, using alcohol or drugs, because we don't want to experience that suffering all over again. But just as the suffering is present in every cell of our body, so are the seeds of awakened understanding and happiness handed down to us from our ancestors. We just have to use them. We have a lamp of mindfulness which we can light anytime. The oil of that lamp is our breathing, our steps, and our peaceful smile. When we speak of listening with compassion, we usually think of listening to someone else. But we must also listen to the wounded child inside us. Sometimes the wounded child in us needs all our attention. That little child might emerge from the depths of our consciousness and ask for our attention. If we are mindful, we will hear his or her voice calling for help. At that moment, instead of paying attention to whatever is in front of us, go back and tenderly embrace the wounded child. We can talk directly to the child with the language of love, saying, 'In the past, I left you alone. I went away from you. Now I am very sorry. I'm going to embrace you.' We have to talk to our child several times a day. Only then can healing take place. Embracing the child tenderly, we reassure him that we will never let him down again or leave him unattended. The little child has been left alone for so long. That is why we need to begin this practice right away. If you know how to go back to her and listen carefully every day for 5 or 10 minutes, healing will take place. When you climb a beautiful mountain, invite your child within to climb with you. When you contemplate the sunset, invite her to enjoy it with you. If you do that for a few weeks or a few months, the wounded child in you will experience healing." So I'll be honest, the first time I read that, I was kind of like, oh, like, ooey, gooey, like, you know, what is that? You know, talking to your child. But to be perfectly honest, I've done a lot of this work through a therapeutic modality called IFS, and it really has helped me a lot to be able to generate self-compassion and to work through things that have happened to me when I was young in a really productive, mindful way, because it's hard. And it's easy and natural to want to avoid feelings that are hard. And often that's exactly what we do. So, I mean, I think the gift of a mindfulness practice is that you generate awareness for your tendencies to avoid. And I think in Zen, there's often a focus to focus on what is happening currently. But I think our experience oftentimes is a bit of an onion. And so your past experiences are feeding into your present, and I think it's probably an error to ignore those things that are bubbling up because they are part of your present experience. And to work with them intentionally in the way that Thich Nhat Hanh is suggesting can be really helpful and create more good and create less harm. So that's kind of all I've got. I'm curious what your thoughts are, what your experiences are.
That was a great talk. Definitely something I've thought about before. When I was in stressful situations or relationships or friendships and found myself meditating a lot, meditating before going to hang out with somebody so that if there was a fight or an argument, I could like make sure I was on my best game. And you can end up like a frog in a pot of boiling water if you keep using meditation as like a band-aid for stuff you need to actually face. So yeah, I don't know. That's an important concept to talk about. I'm glad you talked about it. Thanks.
Thanks. Yeah. No, I feel very much the same way. And it's, I think, as many people find and how I found for myself, is if you don't face it, it will come out in different ways. And because you're more aware of what's currently happening, you'll see what's currently happening, and it's a shit show. So you sort of have no choice at a certain point. But it's interesting, in the Tricycle article with John Wellwood, he mentioned that very often these things show up most often in interpersonal relationships. And that makes a lot of sense to me, because this practice is a very personal, private, sort of isolated journey that we do in community. But you know, when we're all staring silently at the wall, there's not much conflict to really address. And very often that stuff comes up when we're in a different place. So it's, I think, just something to pay attention to and, you know, look at with tenderness and care. So thank you for sharing.
I love this topic. It's so important. It's so cool that y'all are addressing it here. I feel like that's such a good sign for the Zen Center that it's being talked about so openly, and it makes me feel safe here. And I think, like, spiritual bypassing, probably we all do it, you know, in different ways at different times in our life. And, like, I think it's cool that we make progress, and it's not always going to be linear. And it's okay to, like, have a certain amount of bypassing probably, and then, like, address more of it later. That's a type of self-compassion. And then I think when it's hard is in these spiritual communities, when people in power are, like, in super denial about it, or even if they're not in power, like, if you're hurting someone in a relationship by spiritual bypassing, like you mentioned, the narcissist or something like that, that would be sad. But I don't know, I was just thinking about self-compassion, and I guess I was just wondering if for you've uncovered different layers of resistance, I guess, might be the therapy word, or spiritual bypassing.
Yeah, I've definitely experienced resistance in many ways. One example that comes to mind is, I think maybe a year or two ago, one of the talks, I don't remember what exactly inspired this question, but I asked Dave what I should do when my neighbors are annoying me, when they're making sounds that I don't like. And I wanted to know what was the Zen way of dealing with it, because every time it happens, especially when I was meditating, I would just try to meditate the anger or the irritation away, and it felt very un-Zen to be annoyed by, you know, someone just going about their day who is living in their house. And I remember Dave told me basically that it's just a matter of experimentation, and you can try ignoring it and seeing what happens. You can try talking to them and seeing what happens. You can try knocking on their door and showing them how angry you are and seeing what that happens. You know, sometimes people need to see you angry. And I remember thinking, oh my God, go up there and show them that I would never do that. And I was like, well, you know, maybe that's something I should examine. Why am I so scared of my own anger? Why am I so scared of letting someone else know that I'm being inconvenienced and just stuffing it down and trying to make accommodations? And that's something that certainly I've had to do a lot of work on in my own journey. So yeah, that's just one example that I can think of, but I appreciate it, Sam. I'm glad you enjoyed the talk.
Oh, I think it's a really important topic too. I think we should do this talk once a year. Actually, what's coming to mind is the koan that we had you do, that I recommended to you last time. How do you avoid the cold or the heat? Let the heat kill you, let the cold kill you. That is the move to avoid them. So is that spiritual bypass? I'm thinking about, like, the technique to get out of uncomfortable feelings in Zen, if done properly, is you go all the way into them with the promise that eventually they will break and you won't be threatened by them anymore. Is that a bypass? Because of the fact you have to go all the way through it to achieve that. But I also think it's, like, for me, it's a continuous practice. I always find, because, right, like, everything is delusion. If I wasn't delusional, I wouldn't think I existed. And so I always find little things I didn't even notice. I was like, oh, I've really not been, I didn't want to see that. I didn't want to notice that. Like, this week I have some interpersonal, it's a conflict. I don't know if it's conflict. Something kind of a bummer. And I usually think I can just meditate and or tea and or, I think I can usually fix everything if I put all the time and work into it. I did all my things. I was like, oh no, I'm still upset. Oh, this one's real. Sometimes things stick around. But those are my thoughts, I think. Thank you for bringing this up. That's really what I wanted to say.
Yeah, it's an interesting conundrum, because I think that is, like, the classic Zen answer is, like, oh, you're feeling uncomfortable? Like, we'll just sit with that. Like, oh, you're, like, you know, having a hard time? We'll just sit on that. And I think, in theory, the sort of Zen instruction to just sit with it will get you to the end game of acceptance. But I know for me personally, sometimes I need, you know, a little hand holding along the way. And I think that can sort of morph into sort of like a weird, like, machismo sort of thing where you're just sort of like bearing and grinning it. And I think that can be very harmful. I think it goes back to what I was saying about, you know, any tool can be used as a weapon. Sometimes I worry that because sort of like the Zen theology is so focused on non-attachment, non-self, you know, everything is nothing. It's like there's a very thin line between Zen theology and nihilism that I think a lot of people sort of discuss and ask questions about. And, you know, I think it's important to inject some self-compassion into the practice. And I think that can be an intentional. And I don't know if that's the Zen answer, but that's the answer that's worked for me. So if that's tea, you know, that's tea. And if that's, you know, talking to a close friend or a professional, then that's great too. So.
Oh, thank you. This is like extremely important. I think once a year doesn't even cover it. And I think it's incredibly important because like, for a lot of us, I think we came to this practice because something somewhere went wrong in our lives in such a way that we couldn't solve it except by doing this. I don't want to like speak for anyone other than myself, but I'm willing to put money on it that for a lot of us. But yeah, just from what I got from your talk was that like you can't always just skip the steps. Because I do think that in Zen we have these teachings like no self, fundamental Buddhist teaching. So you can go like, well, ultimately, my sense of self is an illusion, and so my thoughts don't really, there's no substance to them, it's all emptiness. But whenever I think that way, I'm like, nah, you're skipping a lot of steps. Or when I hear people say, like, everything is fundamentally perfect, I hate that, because it's like you're skipping so many steps to say that. And yet, sometimes that no self teaching, I think, has really helped me. Or, you know, sometimes trying to see things from that, like, fundamentally perfect perspective can also be helpful. So this is like, I think the tension I feel that like, I don't want to just skip to these like teachings without confronting some of the things that I may have to work on. And yet those teachings are still there and they can also help us. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a tension there. I think there's an argument to be made that some people have made that spiritual bypass is just sort of a stage of development on like a spiritual journey. And I think it's something that inevitably happens to all of us at any stage of practice. And I think in that sense, I mean, it is a part of the journey, you know? And so good for you. You're doing it right. I think that's all I can say.
Hey, thanks for the talk. I think about this a lot, and I'm wondering, does this include like in an outward way, like turning away from the darkness in the world, or like using a spiritual practice to kind of live in like a fantasy world of light? Because that was like what kind of kept me away from a lot of like spiritual stuff for a long time, was knowing people like that. Is that part of this? Or
yeah, I think it certainly can be. I think that can be a symptom of another wound. You know what I mean? Someone who has an obsession with control and wanting everything to be perfect or lovely all the time. I think very often that comes from a wounded place or a place of fear. And I certainly have struggled with that myself as well. You know, wanting things to be great all the time. So I think in a way, yes. I didn't really discuss this in great detail in the talk, but another sort of form of spiritual bypass that people talk about a lot is spiritual narcissism, which Sam sort of pointed to as well, which is sort of this idea that like you are above everything else. You're so spiritually enlightened that no one can touch you. And like truly in your life, everything is perfect and you are perfect. And that can be sort of like a dangerous place to go as well, that I think perhaps people with that notion are blind to some aspects of themselves or the world in a way that could harm themselves or others.
Yeah, this is a great talk. And I don't know, I've been a little bit kind of going in circles listening to, because there's a part of me that's like, you know, especially as householders or lay people, there's a certain amount of it that's a little bit part of the program in a way. You know, as we've been going through challenging stuff, there's things come up. It's like, you know, I just can't deal with this right now. Right. And I think, and there are really unhealthy ways of kind of just pushing it aside. But sometimes, and it gets, for me, it would fall under spiritual bypass of just,
you know, there's different Zen tools. You can be like, okay, I'm just not looking at that. Like, I'm going to change my mindset. And so the idea of, you know, of karma, they're like, okay, who I am and what's happening right now is a result of everything else that's gone on. And that's just, you know, that's something that just allows me to kind of take the pressure off of myself sometimes. But it also, I can put something aside without denying it. And so at some point, I'll probably come around to it. I think it's a slightly healthy, it's a slightly healthier way of avoiding it. And that said, I think part of being aware of when you're doing that, and part of being part of a sangha and having wise friends. Remember, there's a book called Daughters of Copper Woman that was about an indigenous people up in Canada, and especially the women's society. And they basically, and part of things, they would come together and talk about stuff. But one of the rules was, if you kind of come and you complain about something three times without doing anything, they just move the meeting. And that's a little bit radical. But again, the idea is that, okay, yeah, I got to keep an eye on that. If I find, oh yeah, I keep pushing the bypass button over and over, then okay, maybe I can start to notice and do something about it. Yeah, that's my thought.
Thank you, Mota. No, that's awesome. I think that was all very well said, and I'm with you on all that stuff. I mean, first and foremost, you know, out of all the vices you can use to avoid your own bullshit, I think, you know, sitting silently and staring at the wall is the least harmful. I think if that's what you're using, there's worse things to do. And by no means am I suggesting that, you know, we should be examining our trauma and suffering, you know, 24 hours of the day. I think in a way that is sort of the beauty of our practice, is that if you are emotionally bypassing, you're gonna be looking at yourself, and you can only press the button so many times until you gotta look at it. And hopefully that's at a time where you have the bandwidth to do it, which, you know, if you're in the middle of a stressful week, you've got a lot going on already, that may not be the time to look at the things. Maybe that's the time to bypass by staring silently at a wall. And, you know, I think that's okay. Personally, I don't know if that's the right answer, but I'll allow it. Awesome.
Yeah, just wanted to say thanks so much for the talk. Obviously, something that resonated with a lot of us. The reading was funny because I was like when you were going through the possible ways it might show up, I was like, yep, done that one. Yep, there, maybe right now. Like, yeah, covered that, seen it. And then it was like really called me out the depressive stuff, where it was like, you might retreat too far into no self and what are you doing there? So I like the reading. It kind of reminded me of the essay Norman Fisher wrote about stages of monastic practice, which is, you know, just kind of a different way of looking at things. But he talks about this one period called the dry spell, where a lot of really experienced practitioners kind of just fall into this area where, like, it just isn't, the practice just isn't very alive, and they're going through the motions, but it's just not there. And I think that's something, not to any long degree, but I have experienced in my practice where I felt like I was kind of phoning it in. And so I stopped sitting, you know, for a while, or not stop, but I just wasn't like making a priority. But I just wanted to mention that because you also said something in the talk, which I think was really valid, which is that it's normal to go through these things. We're not perfect. You know, it's like, we're not perfect. Practice is practice, which just means that we're practicing, right? And we're not having to get it right all the time. So just thought that was a really helpful reminder. And, you know, I also just am coming back to this whole thing of like, I feel like I'm getting a little bit anew of bursts of energy for Zen just even recently, which, you know, nothing huge has changed, but it's just sort of like my energy has slightly shifted towards it, where I'm like, oh, I'm feeling really pulled in right now, and this is important. And I think that's okay. Like, as you said, like, it's just part of being like real about it and not telling yourself the lie of some kind or another about what your practice is or isn't or should be. So thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Yeah, no, I think you put it beautifully. You know, practice can look all sorts of ways, and a lot of times it doesn't look the way you think it will or the way you want it to. And I think that's perfectly okay and just part of it. And in a way, it's almost a way to practice sort of with, what's the word? Not resolve, not grit, but I guess like kind of grit, you know, like, how are you experiencing an experience that is not the experience you want or not the experience you expected. And I think that can be grounds for a lot of like personal growth and transformation. And, you know, if spiritual bypass is the path through that, then great. You know, you learn something. Cool. Thanks for letting me yap at you for however long.
Also, I believe, if I understand the moral of tonight's talk right, we figured out that if you're going to spiritual bypass, do it mindfully. Does that count?
Grab a cushion, not a handle of whiskey.
Exactly.
Thanks, guys.